Welcome, welcome, welcome to another edition of Smart Talk. This is Al, your host, and glad to have all of you with us today. Today we're going to talk about a new event coming up in October, sponsored by the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences here at the U of A. It's their annual Downtown Lecture Series. And this year, the topic is What Animals Teach Us About Being Human. And I must say, I immediately said, I think I'm always trying to teach my dog. And we have a dog expert, and we also have someone talking about bison and how they are considered people in certain native nations. And I'm just curious as hell to find out what all this stuff is about. But before we get to our two guests, let me tell you a little about the series. It's four Thursdays in October, 6:30 p.m., Fox Theater downtown. And here's the best part. It's free. First come, first serve. You don't need tickets. Walk up, go in, and listen to these brilliant folks from the U of A talk about things tied with animals. So let me give you a quick rundown of the different shows coming up. On October 3rd, Evan McLean, Evan, help me.
McLean,
of course, as in Virginia, is going to talk about the thinking dog. Again, I'm trying forever to get my dog to think, and Evan's going to tell me how he's thinking already. October 10th, Maria Nieves Zedano is going to talk about the personhood of bison. And I can't wait to hear, because she's right here with us today, too, to find out how are bison people, and what's the difference between bison and buffalo? We're going to get to that. October 17th, Alison Hawthorne Deming, one of the great poets in America today, lucky to have her here at the U of A, is going to talk about hunting for herring. And I can't wait to hear about fish and a poet and how did she get involved in that, but it should be fantastic. Finally, on October 24th, our last event will be The Horse as Healer and Educator by Kelsey John. At the U of A. And that sounds stimulating too. I'm going to ask her about horse whisperers and all that stuff, whether that's really true or just a bunch of hokum, et cetera, et cetera. So let's get started. Let's get started right now with our two guests. Welcome, both of you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's great to have you here. Maria, let me start out with you. Folks, let me give you a little background. Maria is the associate research professor in the U of A School of Anthropology. She spent 15 years working with Blackfoot hunters and religious leaders on archaeological projects to uncover the cultural landscape of bison hunting. And I'm going to ask her some questions. 790-2040. That's our call-in number. If you want to ask her some questions, please do. Let me start out with the simplest thing. What is the difference between bison and buffalo?
Oh, that one's easy.
Well, then please tell me.
Bison is the scientific species name, whereas buffalo is an English corruption of the word le bœuf, beef in French, and pardon my French.
Well, that's amazing. So was that with French colonists in Canada and North America somehow coming across the bison and using the word bœuf, and then that became buffalo?
Yeah.
Wow. Fantastic. Fantastic. So tell us a little about what you're going to cover in the talk. Give us a tease that'll make us want to come and listen to you.
Well, I begin with a sense of providing the audience with a sense of when you look at the bison, at our national mammal, you are looking at a survivor. You are looking at a survivor of ecocide and a mass murder massacre. Just as sometimes you, when you see Native American survivors, they are survivors, Native American tribes, from a variety of different traumatic historical events and processes that have brought them to where they are. And that's my beginning, but then I end with a happy note.
I like that. So when you're talking about surviving, you're talking about the what is called the Indian Wars, in which the United States Cavalry and others, as a way of decimating, or in modern warfare, I guess we would talk about civilian bombing or taking out industry as a way of weakening military forces. This was if the tribal nations depended, the Plains Indians, on the buffalo. If you get rid of the buffalo, you weaken, get rid of. Is that how it goes?
Precisely. But that is just one aspect of it. There are other aspects. For example, the construction of the transcontinental railway was actually a major factor in the near extinction of bison, and then the hide trade to supplement leather for the burgeoning industrial revolution globally.
So when you talk about personhood and bison, tell us a little about what you mean by personhood and how the bison do that.
Well, Native American communities, and particularly the Blackfeet tribe and the Blackfoot ethnic group with whom I work and have worked for 15 years, they have their own view of how the world works. And it's a very complex, very complete view. It is not a belief system. It is not a symbolic system. It is not a superstitious system. Is actually a fully developed metaphysical world. And in that world, non-human entities have soul, they have agency, and they are capable of social interaction with one another and with humans. And for example, bison have their own personality, their own system of knowledge, their own memory of experience, and therefore, they are capable of interacting with humans in very specific ways, and not necessarily in losing ways, but in winning ways. If you do not do what you need to engage bison in a partnership, bison simply will not come by your camp, and you will starve to death.
So that raises the obvious question. Let's say we were back then. What would we say? We got a little group right here, a little hunting party or a tribal group right here with Evan, Maria, and Al. What would we need to do vis-a-vis the bison so that we wouldn't starve to death?
Well, let's see. The first thing that you would need to do is do a ceremony. And in that ceremony, you use these particular marine fossils called ammonites. You probably have seen them. They abound in, they are very common in our annual gem and mineral show. And if you fracture those ammonites in a certain way, what you get is a little fossil, you know, the size of, you know, your thumb, that has the shape of a bison. So that ammonite, that fossil, is a magical fossil, and it has the power to bend the will of bison, to actually kill the will of bison, so bison will come to you docile, in a docile manner, rather than stampede away from you.
Gotcha. Is this the Blackfoot belief?
Yeah. It's something that is essential to the hunt.
And if they don't do that, they found that they, what, send off a different vibe in the bison run away too soon, or is it just a belief system independent of what the bison do?
Oh, no. The bison, the fossils and the bison have a very close interaction with one another. So it's inconceivable that you would actually go hunting without your fossil ceremony first. And that is just one small part of what the Blackfoot must do to actually be prosperous and to make sure that their relationship with bison is preserved and is balanced and it's productive.
You know, you mentioned earlier that the bison themselves, a little like Evan's dogs, we're going to get to, think or understand, or can you talk to us a little about, from a bison's point of view, what research or folkways or talking with folks dealing with bison regularly now will tell you about, you know, Al, you may not think this, but they can actually sense, or we found if we do this or that, they... something like that.
Well, one of the advantages of bison is that they form very strong family bonds, and they are always together. If you look at cattle grazing, cattle would spread out in the field and graze on their own. Bison are always grazing in family groups or in, you know, in relative groups. And that makes it very, I would say not easy, but certainly it eases the burden on the hunter to be able to hunt several animals at once.
Wow, I'm going to just jump to Evan for just half a second. Is there an analog with cats and dogs that, now this might just be the layman's view, so please correct me. Dogs seem, well, they use the word packs. I've never heard of, we kind of herding cats as difficult because they don't seem to move together as families. Although I suppose the cat family, lions have prides and you always see them together. Cats and dogs, are they like bison and cattle?
Well, I don't know about the bison and cattle distinction, but I think loosely that probably holds. So dogs are very social animals. They're descended from wolves that live in these family pack structures, and that's something that is less typical for feline species, yeah.
And, you know, for example, Evan mentions the wolf. The Blackfoot learn how to hunt in pack from the wolves, and they recognize that as the wolves giving them the knowledge to be able to hunt bison as a herd rather than individual animals.
Okay, we're going to pick up on that in a second. We got to take a break. 790-2040, give us a call. We're talking about the Downtown Lecture Series starting in October with Evan and Maria, who are talking about bison and dogs and how they affect humans. Stick with us, folks. All right, Al Bergeson, we're back again with Smart Talk. We're going to turn now, even though I told you we're going to keep talking to Maria. We're going to turn now to Evan about dogs and the thinking dog. Give me the sales pitch about, actually, you don't have to. Most people probably will tell you that, yes, their dog does think. They watch them, the eyes follow. What's the latest research on thinking dogs? What do we now know more than we knew before?
Well, I think the most exciting thing about current research with dogs is it recognizes that dogs might be smart in some of the same ways as people. So when we study animal minds, we don't think about intelligence sort of as a one-dimensional thing where we have some animals that are simply smarter than other animals. We think about intelligence as being a constellation of different abilities. So you can have species that are really good at solving one kind of problem, but just hopeless when it comes to solving another kind of problem. So when we think about what makes our species special, there's a lot of emphasis on the way that we understand the social world and communicate and cooperate with each other. And one of the exciting ideas about dogs is that dogs have evolved many of those same abilities. So essentially what allows us to have these remarkable relationships and these remarkable communicative systems with dogs is that they have cognitive expertise in a way that is similar to what we have as humans.
Give us an example.
So an example would be something like reading body language. So one of the first things that we do with our children before they have language, when they're only 9 months of age, is we start using gestures, things like pointing to communicate non-verbally. And it comes naturally to us, so we don't think about it. But it turns out if you look for those abilities in humans' close relatives, like chimpanzees or bonobos, it's a kind of communication that they don't really understand well because you just don't sort of voluntarily cooperate and share information in that way. But it's something that comes very naturally to dogs, and they don't have to live with people to be able to do this. We can test puppies that are only 9 weeks old. They've barely opened their eyes and are, you know, just sort of coming to understand the world around them. And already they sort of have this understanding of our communication. So we think it's something really in dog biology.
Wow. So you could imagine sitting here and there would be a chimp and a dog. And if I were to look over to the corner of the room, the dog's eyes would look over where I was looking and the chimp's wouldn't. And the chimp would say, God, you know, everyone thinks that dog's smart. He's not smart. Everyone knows chimps are 10 times smarter. I'm not an idiot. But these dogs have been raised so much with humans that evolutionarily they have these social cues and they can do some things that I can't. They're like bats are great at night, but you know, bats aren't going to write a symphony, but they got their radar going. Humans don't have radars. They bang into things at night. Is that more or less it?
Yeah, it's close. There's a lot of subtlety here because in the example you just gave, the chimp might follow where you're looking depending on why you're doing that. So yeah. If you think you know where there's a piece of food and you're going to go try and get it for yourself, they'll pick up on that cue that you looked somewhere and they'll exploit that because they're competing with you. So it's really just using those cues in cooperative context. So if you look to show a chimpanzee where food is, then they don't use that information because they don't expect that you'd ever be motivated to help them, whereas dogs do.
Gotcha. Tim, we got Tim on the line. Tim, you got a question, please.
Yes, I do. This is for Maria.
Absolutely.
Anyway, she's got a fascinating career. That's amazing. But the question is, I've sort of heard about these drive lines before, and that sort of the herding the buffalo into a kill site. How do they build those things in? And how's that done? Can you give me a little more information?
Oh, yes. Drive lines are built of our linear features align on the landscape in a funnel shape, a V shape. And the widest part of the drive is on the grassland. And the narrowest part of the drive is right above a deadfall, a cliff. So they are built and aligned with the topography. And the most important quality property of a good driveline, a successful driveline, is the fact that when bison are stampeding toward the cliff, they will not be able to see it until they are upon it. And that is one of the most beautiful abilities that bison hunters had, reading the landscape so that they could actually, engage the bison and trick the bison into moving and stampeding within these fences. Now, I have heard from modern ranchers, that bison naturally follow fences. And you were asking me all about the bison behavior. Well, they naturally follow fences. So ancient hunters figure out just by watching them move on the landscape that they could follow fences, and therefore they build them. And they are built for miles and miles and miles.
Fantastic. Tim, thanks for your question. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Tim.
Evan, back to the dogs. Give us a tease on what you're going to talk about when you do your downtown lecture series.
Sure. Well, the first question we're going to consider is we're just going to basically look at the dog-human relationship as a puzzle. And most people don't think about it that way, but dogs are the descendants of wolves, and wolves are dangerous carnivores that eat other animals. And for tens of thousands of years, we have managed to have a relationship with dogs where we have a great degree of trust with them, and we have them in our lives. And we don't do this with other animals. Dogs were the first domesticated animal. So there's a lot of questions about what is it that makes this work, and why dogs and not any of the other numbers of species that we might have formed this relationship with.
And the answer is?
Well, we don't entirely know the answer, but we think that dogs, the emotional systems of dogs and the cognitive systems of dogs have changed in ways that allow them to form relationships with us and understand us and communicate with us in ways that other species don't. One of the fun ideas that we're going to consider is that some of the changes that happened in dog domestication that allow them to do that might be some of the same things that happened in human evolution, changes that happened to our species. So we're going to entertain this idea that even though we're, from a biological perspective, very distantly related to dogs, we're going to entertain the idea that there might have been sort of similar changes in human evolution and dog domestication.
It's either a New Yorker cartoon or it's not. But there's a caveman, and there's a cave, and it's raining, and there's a wolf standing out front, and he's looking, and one of the cave people wants to let him in. The other one turns and says, once you let him in, they'll be with us forever. What is the sense? Is it humans took pups to help with hunting or carrying, as on the plains?
Absolutely.
Or is it that the wolves said, hanging with these guys, maybe there's some scraps. Which side is the best there? I know no one knows. It goes way back in early history, but What's the thinking?
Well, that's great. I mean, you really just articulated two of the main sort of debates. And one perspective is that humans and wolves at the time sort of forged these alliances in terms of hunting. And so there's even an idea that one of the reasons that Neanderthals went extinct is because dogs helped humans hunt in ways that Neanderthals couldn't. So dogs could track large game. They could follow them over these great distances, and they could surround them. And they made it easy for people, because people could then come in later and they wouldn't have to physically engage with these large animals that are hard to tackle. And they could let the dogs sort of circle up these animals and then use projectile weapons, things like spears, to hunt them. Whereas maybe Neanderthals couldn't do that. And there's some evidence that if you look at injuries in Neanderthals, they have injuries that are like the injuries that we see in modern rodeo participants. So the kinds of injuries that you suffer when you are basically getting, you know, beat around by a big, tough animal. And maybe dogs helped us avoid that. But the other idea, as you mentioned, is that maybe dogs were essentially sort of attracted to a human niche where we had garbage or refuse, and it was really only sort of the tamer, more docile animals that could benefit there, and more aggressive or fearful animals sort of had to stay further away from humans. So over time, you get selection for these animals that have more dog-like sort of emotional characteristics, tamer, more gentle animals.
I mean, Maria, let me kick the ball to you. Is there a similar Blackfoot or any Plains tribal nation for whom the dog has a similar mythology and place in their cosmic picture as the bison?
Well, they are two very different non-human persons. Bison was created by the creator on Earth, Old Man Napi, for example, in Blackfoot, whereas the dog or the wolf dog came from the sky when the creator came down to create nature, to create the world. He brought his pet companion. So they have been together. It came from the sky. They have been together since the beginning of time, before humans were here, before bison were here, certainly. So they are two very different entities. Now, communal hunts avoided having dogs in them because dogs bark. So all the dogs were muzzled during the communal hunt, the communal bison hunt. In other societies, on the other hand, dogs are trained to hunt.
Interesting, interesting. You know, Evan, when you said the dog-human alliance, I thought, oh my God, here's the first example of international relations. Or, I mean, so it's interspecies relations. I mean, what a great thing. The human, I don't know if we could use these things. And the dog, I don't know. How about a tentative? We'll try it a little together. And then before you know it, millions of years have passed. And
that's
here
right.
We have Bowser, our little pet. And we're becoming one. Give me a quick synopsis of what your research is. What are you doing now, and what really fascinates you?
Yeah, so in our lab, the Arizona Canine Cognition Center, we study people's pet dogs. So if anyone has a dog and wants to sign up and participate, you can visit us online at dogs.arizona.edu. And we basically bring dogs to our center on campus, and we design tests for them that are similar to the tests that you might do with young human children to try and get answers about the way that their minds work, how they're similar and different to humans. And we also use that information in different kinds of applied contexts to try to figure out, for example, what aspects of cognition predict whether a dog will be a good assistance dog or a military detection dog. So basic research as well as these applied questions about how an understanding about the dog's mind can help us as well.
Evan, can I bring my puppy, Nico?
Absolutely can.
Yeah, she's 12 weeks old right now, but she's really smart. I mean, and I was going to ask you, do dogs have personalities? Different personalities?
Sure. It depends who you ask. A lot of people don't like the word personality.
Let's make it concrete. Poodles are known to be, right or wrong, finicky, emotional, prickly, temperamental, and smart. And what is it? Labs. Friendly. You can kick them. You can love them. You can do everything. They're great with kids.
Yeah. So, I mean, well, so there's two different things that you just talked about, because what Nieves is talking about when you say personality, personality is really a measure of individual differences, right? So it's between different animals, and do they have different characteristics? Are some sort of more shy or some more curious and outgoing? And for sure, that's the case. We have lots of good evidence for that in dogs. What you're talking about, Al, is breed differences, right? So between the different breeds that we have are these sort of, are there these characteristic patterns where certain breeds
bred to be ratters or things like that?
Potentially, sure. Yeah. And everybody's intuition is that the answer to that question is yes, because if you've if you've had a Chihuahua and you've had a Lab, you most people mm-hmm. believe that there are some fundamental differences between those breeds. But honestly, there's not a ton of data on these questions right now. So it's one of the things that we work on, is trying to bring some science to these questions where intuition has predominated for a long time.
Fantastic. We're going to take a break here. We're with Evan and Nieves. Instead of you guys are colleagues, and you don't say Maria, so
Nieves is my middle name, but my friends call me Nieves.
Yeah, I've just met you, but I'm going to call you Nieves if I'm not too forward, rather than just Maria. 790-2040. Give us a call. We'll be back in a few seconds. Smart Talks, thanks for staying with us. We're back again with Evan McLean and Nieves Cedeno about, I don't know if I botched that one, I just did it without looking.
But don't worry about it.
What? No, thank you, you're great. Talking about the upcoming Downtown Lecture Series sponsored by the U of A. It's at the Fox Theater on Congress Street, 17 West Congress Street. Doors open at 6 p.m. You can walk in free. There are no tickets. First come, first serve. We have a great lineup of speakers from the U of A. So coming up first on October 3rd is Evan, who's with us today, talking about the thinking dog. Coming up October 10th is Nieves, who is talking about the personhood of bison. We're going to get right back to her in a second. The 17th is Alison Hawthorne Deming, a great poet, talking about hunting for herring, and Kelsey John, the horse as healer and educator, on October 24th. We've got another caller. Sally, you're on the air. What's up?
Hi. I'm wondering, Nieves, how much did communal hunting contribute to the extinction of the bison?
Communal hunting? Well, there were, at the time of contact, there were anywhere between 30 million and 60 million bison on the North American plains, and even into the Ohio River. Those numbers were like exponentially larger than the number of hunters, of course. So there was more than abundant bison for communal hunts, even large communal hunts where you could kill up to 50 or 100 animals in one hunting event. Yet within 50 years, bison went from several million to 500 animals left on the continent. And that was industrial, unassailed, wanton hunting of bison. So communal hunting did not affect at all the numbers of bison. In fact, because communal hunters also managed the grassland through prescribed fire, they were actually promoting bison growth and promoting the expansion of bison environments rather than extracting bison from the environment.
Thanks, Sally. That was a good question. I think Sally hung up, which is good. You know, as I understand it, and help me with this, there was something called the New Western History. And I think one, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, one of the theses was that the difference between native nations and then Europeans coming west from the 13 colonies or the United States was not so much that they were doing the same thing. It was just a scale issue, that there was, if you will, not destroying the bison there, but the scale just went up. But it sounds like you're pointing to something more than just scale, but real intention in almost a military purpose.
Yes.
Or just maybe if it's hunting just for meat, maybe it is just a scale thing, but on the other part of undermining Native nations' resistance to the expansion of the United States, it's not.
Absolutely. And the Secretary of Interior under President Grant in 1873 wrote a report about the fact that the less bison there are, the easier it will be to subjugate Native Americans into producing from the soil rather than taking from nature. And there was this idea that hunters, because they did not produce anything,
yes,
they were wasting resources and wasting the land, whereas farmers were producing food, and therefore they should be supported and promoted. So yeah, bison was systematically and intentionally killed. And if the audience has heard about Buffalo Bill Cody, well, Buffalo Bill Cody was actually a government employee in charge of systematically killing bison.
Wow. Let's talk a little about what you actually do. This is great for folks to hear about what people at the university do. You're an archaeologist.
Yes.
And we normally think of archaeologists as digging up in the ground, finding pot shards, that's pieces on it, of pots, and their dispersion or what they say on them or whatever about them, and then they make inferences about earlier times and earlier peoples. Buffalo hunting seems difficult to turn into an archaeological thing, particularly when we're talking about Plains and Indians in the 19th century. How do you do that?
Well, it's an archaeology of bone and stone. So
I like that, bone and stone.
Yeah. So what you do is you look at, for example, you look at bison bone beds that sometimes you find along at the bottom of ridges, you know, along the river, for example, at the bottom of ridges and cliffs. And once you find them, you can actually go up on the ridge and see if there are these linear features made built of a stone. And once you find them, if you find them, you begin to walk farther and farther and farther away from the cliff until you find the end of that particular drive line. It's a lot of walking because they don't show up in satellite imagery. And until the invention of the GPS, you probably are familiar with the GPS because you have them in new cars. Until the invention of the GPS, you couldn't really record all of those features like we do now.
Yeah, because I'm trying to understand here. You're talking about driving bison off cliffs, right? So when you uncover remains, are you finding, you know, just a fragment of like a single bone, or are these like sort of mass sites where you find, you know, the remains of many bison that have been driven off a cliff?
Oh, the bone beds are so large that sometimes you can only excavate a fraction of them. And if you have come into my lab, Evan, you have, all of those hundreds of boxes in my lab are nothing but bone. And a lot of those sites were destroyed in the early 1900s because bone was so good, so necessary for fertilizer. And during World War II, also it was used in the weapon industry because of the amount of phosphorus that it contains, that a lot of those sites were mined systematically. So we are very lucky to have in the Blackfeet Indian Reservation a large number of archaeological sites, both bone beds and also rock features that are still very well preserved.
How helpful have the Blackfeet been for you in terms of finding sites where people, I mean, you could imagine loads of cliffs and you could say, okay, they could drive them here and you dig, found nothing. Damn. I mean, you know, time would be, do they point out some classic ones that's been passed down in lore? What's it like actually working with a tribe on your architectural digs?
Yeah.
Archaeological.
Wonderful. I could not have dreamed of a better partner than the Blackfeet tribe. First of all, I have worked with them for 15 years in various projects, not just archaeological projects. So we have built a relationship of honesty and trust.
What's your initial pitch when you go in?
Well, I went in to invite them to participate in a different project in North Dakota, and they liked what I said, what they heard from me. And then a few months later, they called me and said, Maria, we need you to do this project for us. Could you help us do this research? Because nowadays in North American archaeology, you work at the pleasure and at the invitation of tribes. You no longer barge in and say, we will do this. They tell you, you can do it or cannot. Or they say, could you help us do this? And we do it together. The Blackfeet love science. And I love the idea of better understanding their philosophy in order to improve the way in which we do science.
When you think about the personhood, the cosmology, that's a fancy word for worldview of the whole, yeah. you know, God and the cosmos and just the whole enchilada, the whole ball of wax. It has its origins when the life of the tribe and the life of the bison were a lot closer. Are there remnants of it today, and how does it manifest when you're out just talking with folks today on in Blackfeet country?
Well, first of all, they have their own bison herd. That is part of my my lecture on October 10th. They have a Confederacy-wide international initiative to bring bison back into the plains. And at the same time, because they have been able to recover a lot of their ceremonial items from museums and repositories across the country, they are now, and this is happening to many other tribes across the plains and in Canada and the U.S., they are being able to restore and renew that essential part of the relationship between the hunter and the bison, which is the ceremonial aspect, the mystical aspect of that relationship, of that partnership.
How general is this centerpiece of bison? So other plains peoples, Comanche, Kiowa, Sioux, is the bison similarly at the center of worldviews?
Well, a bison is a very important part of their diet and also of their cosmos. But every ethnic group, let's say, along the Missouri River Basin related to it differently. There were farmers who hunted bison as a secondary source of food and tools and et cetera. There were hunters who farmed a little bit. Then there were hunters who hunted bison primarily, but they hunted very many other animals as well, and trapped and fish. And then there were bison specialists like the Blackfoot who didn't hunt for food any other animal except in dire circumstances. Bison was their only real food, and anything else were nothing foods.
Fantastic. 790-2040 is our number for you to call in and ask some questions. We're going to take a break now, and we'll be back in a minute. Stick with us.
Have you ever thought of taking classes on subjects that are important in today's society? The College of Social and Behavioral Sciences is now presenting courses for the Tucson community this fall on topics such as Brexit, guns in America, food writing, and Mexican superheroes. These courses are taught by some of the leading professors in their fields. This is open to the public. Register today at communityclassroom.arizona.edu. That's communityclassroom.arizona.edu.
The University of Arizona College of Education is focused on innovation, which is why our research is at the forefront of educational and social reform. Our graduates include teachers, of course, but also leaders, researchers, counselors, deaf interpreters, school psychologists, special education teachers, principals and superintendents. An education degree can serve as the foundation for a career in law, nursing, writing, and so much more. Just ask our alumni. Learn more at coe.arizona.edu.
Welcome back. We're back again with Smart Talk. I'm Al, your host, and with Evan and Nevis talking about the forthcoming downtown lecture series sponsored by the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, the Fox Theater right there on 17 West Congress. It's free. Show up. Doors open at 6. Walk in, take a seat, listen to a wonderful range of faculty people who are going to talk about really exciting research. We got two of them on today. We're going to have some more on later. Evan, part of what you're going to talk about are our relationships with dogs. What has your research or others found that the ordinary person might not think of about dogs? I mean, take a second. If you were to say, well, dogs are good companions. Oh, man, I hear the yawn already, and someone's pushed the button on the radio dial to go to someone else. If you say, you know, dogs seem attached to us, I also get bored. Tell me something I don't know about our relationship with dogs.
Well, I think where it gets interesting is how those relationships get literally under your skin, how they change our biology and our physiology. And people started looking at this decades ago, for example, in studies of people who had heart attacks, and they were trying to figure out, well, you know, what's going to predict whether somebody survives one of these events or not. And there was a famous study that showed that people with pets at home were about five times more likely to still be alive a year after a heart attack than people without pets. And that got everybody's attention because it suggested that, well, you know, maybe there's actually something to this, and it's not just sort of a furry little pet that lives in your house, but maybe we actually get something, you know, that helps our health out of these relationships. So one of the things that we and others have been studying is neuroendocrine responses to dogs. And basically, that's just a fancy way to talk about hormonal changes that happen in the body when we interact with dogs. And one of the interesting discoveries is that when people engage in the kinds of characteristic friendly ways that they interact with pets, you know, petting them, looking into their eyes, it actually stimulates release of a hormone called oxytocin that is critically involved in the parent-infant bond, also involved in bonds between romantic partners. And we think this is really sort of part of the underlying physiology of if we talk about love in a biological sense, we think this is really one of those mechanisms. And this can do all kinds of things. It can lower your blood pressure, lower your stress levels, can promote, it's an anti-inflammatory in your body. And so there's all kinds of things, positive effects that might come out of our relationships with dogs that we're just beginning to understand.
Wow. Two questions. One, is it better with dogs to have this kind of relationship, or is it any animal? I'll overdo it for dramatic purposes. Parakeet? Well, obviously, you can interact less with a parakeet. Cats, let's take something that's a similar kind of four-legged thing.
Yeah, the shorter answer is we don't know, but there are some things that dogs do that are less common in other animals that we know are a part of this response. So, for example, when people have looked at, well, what is it about dogs that causes this kind of physiological response? One of the main things is eye contact. So when your dog sort of gives you those puppy dog eyes and looks at you in this loving way, that very behavior is what stimulates some of these physiological changes. And one of the ways we know this is incredible because people have basically given dogs oxytocin as a drug. And that causes the dogs to spend more time looking at your face. And then when the dogs spend more time looking at your face, you have a higher increase in oxytocin yourself. So it's kind of a crazy thing because you basically give a drug to the dog, it changes the dog's behavior towards you, and as a consequence of that, your biology changes.
Where can I get a prescription? Because I am having a hard time training my little puppy, and my husband and I spend an awful lot of time arguing about different ways to train the puppy. I need that medicine. I need oxytocin.
Well, oxytocin is the natural biology of our social relationships in many ways, and I think your pup is going to give you plenty.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to hear that.
You know, you're talking about, perhaps, and fill me in, a scientific basis for the old maxim that if you want to meet someone or go dating, either for a second marriage or just dating in general, walk your dog where other people are walking their dogs. And I originally thought that was just because that's a way to meet people, but that would also be go to a supermarket, go to a bus station or everything else. But if what you're hinting at is correct, with the dog and you what, help me here, open up some, give off some, you know, something or other, and so does the other person, and the chances statistically of a match or connection are better with two people walking a dog than just two people alone?
I don't know. There are interesting studies showing that dogs have what people talk about as a social lubricant effect. So if you have a dog, I mean, if you think about it, if we leave here today and you go outside and you come across somebody, if they have a dog versus they don't have a dog, it's just so much easier to strike up a conversation with the person who has a dog compared to something else. And there have been funny studies about this. For example, a French study where they put a young man on a corner, either with a dog or with something besides a dog, I think a stuffed animal or something, and his job was to get as many phone numbers from young women as he could, and he was much more successful with the dog. That's sort of a silly example, but we know that there are sort of real cases where this could be important. So, for example, people with disabilities, someone in a wheelchair, for example, they're much more likely to have social interactions with others when they're accompanied by a dog than when they're not. So we think people think about this in terms of social capital, or this idea that we live in, a society where we feel good about things and can interact with each other. And there's a lot of thinking that dogs sort of help us get into those states.
You know, listening to the radio, there was an ad for some kind of companion dog for returning veterans with either PTSD or just adjusting. And they would have some of these folks, you know, testify and saying, you know, it's really been helpful that Dogs for Vets, or whatever it was called, was able to provide a dog for me, and it's helped my readjustment. And that really makes your case.
It does, yeah. And it's a sort of an emerging thing right now, but there are lots and lots of assistance dogs being placed with veterans with PTSD. And part of it is the companionship. Part of it is things that the dogs are actually trained to do. So, for example, a veteran with PTSD may be nervous to walk into a dark space or turn a corner not knowing what's on the other side. And these dogs are trained to sort of go out in front of the person and make sure things are okay, and then give the person a signal like, it's okay, we can go here, or warn the person, there's people around here, just so that, it's a little bit easier to live your life. For that matter, people wake up in the middle of the night with post-traumatic stress disorder, having these night terrors and flashbacks, and just having the dog there as a companion can do a lot for mental health.
Yeah. Comfort dogs.
Exactly. Emotional support.
Mm-hmm. I remember, at least in academics, some people would come in with a dog. I know my sister worked in Hollywood, and she would bring her dog in, and I always thought that was sort of an affectation. And then I started hearing about things called comfort dogs. What do we know about that?
Well, we know that people seem to respond very positively to it. There's a lot of science that's not quite there yet. So it's a hard thing, because there's a lot of believers that this has value, and that when we think about the kinds of treatments that we might use for people, that we should consider dogs seriously here. But we're at a point right now where there's just not enough data that, legislators will say, well, this is, just as good as pill X or intervention Y, whatever they might want to use here. So we're learning about it, and there's active research programs on this. A lot of them look like they're heading in promising directions, yeah, but there's still a lot to learn. Yeah.
I have also heard and read that there are prisons across the country where prisoners are allowed to have a pet companion, and it improves their mood and their attitude quite a bit. Is that true?
Yeah, that's right. Actually, I just had a meeting this week with folks at the Humane Society of Southern Arizona, and they have a great program, the New Beginnings Program, where they train, or they have inmates who train some of these dogs at the shelter, and the benefits are mutual. The dogs that get all this time with a person, investing energy and sort of building skills and relationships with the dogs, those dogs seem to get adopted out more quickly. They can help them sort of attain a better rehomable state. And of course, the inmates themselves get a lot out of this. So it's an interesting model, and it's one that's being used all over the place now, and I think it has benefits for both dogs and people alike.
It's interesting, the notion of a walk in the woods, hospitals with windows open to nature versus hospitals without, studies of exiting from the hospital quicker, repairing your body easier, the oneness with nature, which has sort of been a green philosophy idea. But it sounds like with the dogs and other pets, companions, and all these physical things you talk about, that the originally green philosophy idea, or the right thing to do about we are one with nature, is increasingly getting grounded in actual research and science.
Yeah, that's right. It's rooted in an idea called biophilia, which is basically, the love of life or love of nature. And certainly for the vast majority of human history, we have been, directly involved with all aspects of our environment. And we're in a little bit of a weird state now, in that we live in a highly artificial world with less and less contact with the natural world around us. So it's one idea why people have pets in general, not just dogs, is that we sort of need this connection to the natural world. And through having companion animals, that helps keeps us grounded.
Fantastic. So we got a few minutes left. What I'd like to do now is to turn to each of you and let you talk a little about why folks should come down and hear your particular talk. And then they should hear all of them. That's my job. But why they should hear each one of you and what you have to offer and how exciting it's going to be. Who wants to go first?
Evan.
Sure. Well, so in part, I would plug my talk, but I would also plug the whole series because the series is constructed around this idea of animalities and what animalities tell us about humans, and it goes right back to the theme that we were just discussing about our sort of connection to nature that in modern times is really easy to lose sight of. But there is so much in our relationships with animals and in studying animals that we can learn about ourselves and our place in the world. And all of the talks in the series are going to address that from really different but complementary perspectives. And I think it's just such a fun thing to do. I've had the privilege of getting previews of some of the other talks, and I have learned so many things about the importance of different animals in the lives of humans that I had no idea about. And I'm a scientist who studies animals and our connections to animals. So certainly if I can learn things that I find fun and fascinating, I think everyone will have that opportunity. In terms of my talk in general, I think, about half of the people listening probably have a dog, and we think we know so much about them just sort of intuitively. But one of the things we know from psychology is everybody feels like they're an expert about their own mind or that the sort of, personal experiences we have in the world. But sometimes science can tell us that actually things don't work exactly the way like they seem they do. And so it will be fun for people to come and take what they've learned about dogs just living in their own lives and hear how that sometimes aligns and sometimes doesn't align with the science that we have that actually tells us a little bit more about what's going on inside a dog's mind or what might be going on when we have interactions or relationships with them.
I think there are a lot of prejudices about dogs, and most of them are positive. And it's sort of nice to have some science to support when you might feel guilty about talking to your dog and say, well, it's just a dog. No, Evan studies this, and actually it changes this and that. Maria.
Well.
Oh, Nevis. Both Maria and Nevis. Talk to us.
Well, the general public sometimes has this idea, this idea that archaeologists is about painstakingly brushing a stone, a bone, a pot, and in this tiny little hole, this confined area. And what my talk will give the audience is a sense of just how vast the bison hunting landscape was and how much land was necessary, how carefully the grassland had to be taken care of, and simply a sense of grandeur, a sense of, yes, nature can be seen archaeologically, social relations can be seen archaeologically, but at a very large scale.
And is the bison coming back?
Oh, come to my lecture and I'll let you know about it.
I like that. I like that. I like that. All right, let me sum up for what we got. We got two great talks coming up on October 3rd at the Fox Theater, 17 Congress Street, West Congress Street, Evan McLean on The Thinking Dog. And the next week, October 10th, we've got Maria Nevis Cedeno on The Personhood of the Bison and talk about her research with the Blackfeet Tribe and how the bison is understood and what's happening today and all the archaeology of coming to these conclusions that she does. The 17th, Allison Hawthorne Deming, a poet talking about hunting for herring from a poet's point of view. And we're going to close it out with October 24th with Kelsey John talking about the horse as healer. It's a downtown lecture series, a Fox Theater. It's free. Come on down, walk in, and enjoy it. So for Smart Talk, for Evan, and for Maria, this is Al Bergeson. See you next time.